So there's some other amendments that have been added from the original bill that fine-tune things a little bit to make sure that it's only sworn officers are going to be asked to report, required to report, and some unclear language with regard to how soon that report needs to be, and then some controversy over whether or not the trapping language would still be retained that was passed last session. Really, it's very straightforward. We feel that we should have the same obligations in this day and age as physicians and others in reporting aggravated animal abuse, and pay a fine if we do not, and would hope that the committee would look favorably on such legislation.
All right. Are there questions for Senator Schrader?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Senator, how do you, so that we don't have people wrongly accused, how do you tell the difference between animal abuse and just an injury? You know, an animal's been injured by doing whatever, you know, whatever they do.
Sure. Mr. Chair.
I obviously can't tell you.
Sure. That's a good question, Representative. Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell. That's the reason this bill is specific with regard to aggravated animal abuse. And I think in the statutes there are different levels of abuse that are defined. This makes it very clear. It's kind of like a per type of case. Be very clear and unambiguous as to whether or not this has been intentional, reckless, you know, really serious, to avoid the very problem that you're talking about, and you'll get some testimony from others to that effect.
Okay. Follow up?
You may.
And the difference between this and between animal abuse and, you know, if a rancher were to decide that they, you know, they need to put an animal down, or an animal owner of any kind were to determine that they needed to put an animal down and took it into their own hands as opposed to taking the animal to a professional such as yourself, how would they, is that going to be classified as abuse? And
sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, again, that would not even come close to qualifying for aggravated animal abuse. This is a big issue. The reason, again, the bill is specific, the language in the bill is very specific, and it's there because the veterinary world, as well as, quite frankly, the culture of our state, there's an eastern side of this state and a western side, and different levels of care and attendance are commonplace and accepted as fine. So I think it's important that there's an opportunity for differences in cultures here. This, again, with the aggravated animal abuse language, makes it very, very clear. We had great support from both the eastern side and western side veterinarians on this particular bill. Good comments.
And Representative Crummell, just as the statute relates back to the definition of aggravated animal abuse in 167.322, it defines that as a person maliciously kills an animal or B, intentionally or knowingly tortures an animal, and it defines maliciously as intentionally acting with a depravity of mind and reckless and wanton disregard for life, and torture means an action taken for the primary purpose of inflicting pain.
Okay.
So it seems to me that given the nature of the Section 3, the veterinarian would have to have reasonable cause to believe, given the evidence that he sees with respect to treatment of the animal, that it fits into this category, this level of depravity. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Anything else for the Senator before we let him get back to his more important task of balancing our budget?
One of the tasks, sir.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
I know where he's going and what he's going to do, and what I hear about the budget, maybe we'd better off keep him here.
Yeah, that would be that's a fair comment. That is a fair comment. All right, thanks, Senator.
Thank you very much.
We'll excuse you now. While we're on this bill, there are only another short panel of witnesses, so why don't we wrap it up. Lieutenant Randy Covey from the Oregon Humane Society and Marsha Keith and Dave Barrows, if you two would please come forward.
With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, we'll go first.
And then
he's a great cleanup hitter.
Fair enough.
Speaking of House Bill 3606, but who was?
We'll have a committee prohibition on baseball metaphors.
Accepted, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dave Barrows and Marcia Keith representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. If you'll turn, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to the second page of the bill at the bottom, you will see under Section 7 the existing law. Sub 1 is the current state of the law, and what it simply says is that if a licensed veterinarian or a veterinary technician believes an animal to be abandoned, neglected, or abused, they may report it. They are permitted to report it to an appropriate authority, and in that case, if they do it in good faith, they receive a shield. That's the current state of the law. In this bill, we are ratcheting it up a step, and a very important step, to say, however, in the case of aggravated animal abuse, and Mr. Chairman, you have done what I had planned to do, which was to kind of spell it out, what that meant. In that case, a veterinarian is mandated to report to the appropriate authorities. Now, we have worked out with folks who were a little antsy about lines 19 on page 1, lines 19 through 22, about humane societies and municipal and county animal control agencies and who would know what they were talking about and so forth. We've fixed that on the Senate side. On the Senate side, there were people who signed up to oppose this bill or expressed concern. They're not here today because I think we have made it the kind of bill that they can now live with. It's an important step forward, Mr. Chairman, as the Senator pointed out, and we urge the committee's support of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Barrows. Marcia?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I really don't have anything to add. I'm just here to give Dave moral support.
We know he needs a lot of that. Lieutenant Covey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lieutenant Randy Covey, employed by the Law Enforcement Division of the Oregon Humane Society, here today in support of Senate Bill 255, the A engrossed version. This is a good bill. This bill recognizes the relationship between human and animal abuse. It requires veterinarians to report the worst types of abuse. It also allows veterinarians and staff to report other types of abuse, neglect, abandonment, without fear of civil or criminal liability. I commend the OVMA and Senator Schrader for authoring and sponsoring this bill. The Oregon Humane Society believes that all types of abuse and neglect should be reported, and we support this bill as a great step towards ensuring that people who commit animal crimes are held accountable. If I could just respond briefly to Representative Crummell's concerns, I'd like to add a little bit to that. This does require veterinarians to report what they suspect to be aggravated animal abuse. The safeguard for people that are suspected of this is that would simply result in an investigation, which would then go further in determining whether, in fact, the concerns are valid. We routinely, in the Law Enforcement Division of the Oregon Humane Society, investigate concerns and allegations. Very few of those result in actual prosecution because our job is to conduct a fair investigation and determine the best course of action. So I hope that will alleviate some of your concerns. Veterinarians provide, in any case, whether they report it or not, some of the most key evidence in an animal crime investigation. We support this bill because it encourages veterinarians to look for issues that may ultimately increase the chance that there would be some form of human abuse committed by the perpetrators of animal abuse. It will assist our investigations. It will make for stronger cases, but it does allow for safeguards both for the veterinarians in reporting it and for the people that are suspected of committing these crimes.
Thank you, Lieutenant Covey. Are there questions for the Lieutenant? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chairman. My questions have to do with the commercial industries. I'm thinking of dairies in particular, which I pick on with by design, you know, here. I'm not sure the veterinarian makes the accusation or of animal abuse. So what is the process from here on out?
Sure. Members of the committee, Representative Jensen. It's a good question. I guess what I'd like to clarify, first of all, is that this particular bill deals simply with animal cases that veterinarians become aware of. It doesn't create the crime of aggravated animal abuse. So if there are issues related to whether it be dairy farmers or any other person that deals with animals, the crimes are already in place. What this creates is a mechanism, a requirement for veterinarians themselves to report it and provide some safeguards when they do so.
Mr. Chairman, could I add one thing to that?
Certainly.
Representative Jensen. On line 14, you will find included a specific exemption. And it says, it cites an ORS 167-335. That is a long list, and I don't have it all with me, but I looked at it today, and I did write down some of the items. It includes animal husbandry, wildlife management, fishing and hunting, commercial production of animals, rodeos, scientific research. All these are accepted. They do not mean aggravated animal abuse under this bill. So all commercial activities would not be included.
All commercial.
Yes.
Go ahead. All commercial activities. That is it impossible for a dairy owner operator to abuse an animal?
It is
under this statute.
I would defer to the learned counsels on this committee and to the committee counsel, but it is my belief that aggravated animal abuse under this proposed statute says it does not include any exception listed in ORS 167-335, and that includes animal husbandry and the commercial production of animals. So the answer to your question, I believe, is it does not include them and would not include them.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't have the statute in front of me. I think what we're getting at is that any practice that constitutes animal husbandry is not aggravated animal abuse. You can have a dairy farmer, I guess, commit aggravated animal abuse if the dairy farmer, in fact, is engaging in conduct that's proscribed by the aggravated animal abuse statute. So, but that's conduct outside of animal husbandry. Wouldn't that be about right?
Yes. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, if I could add to that, Representative Jensen, the exemption that's listed does stipulate that unless gross negligence can be shown, the provisions of the aggravated animal abuse statute don't apply to commercial livestock operations. However, what that does simply is it raises the bar in terms of proving that a crime has been committed. It does allow for, as Representative Shetterly pointed out, what we commonly call community standards, acceptable community standards in terms of, in the case of dairy cattle, the good animal husbandry practices associated with that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that somebody can go out and create a gross crime against a dairy cow or any other animal and get away with it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, again, there's only two, Representative Jensen, there are only two ways you can commit aggravated animal abuse. One is to maliciously kill an animal. Maliciously is defined as intentionally acting with a depravity of mind and reckless and wanton disregard of life. And number two, intentionally or knowingly torture an animal. And torture means an action taken for the primary purpose of inflicting pain. And so I would agree with Representative Shetterly that a dairy farmer could do one of those two things, but that would not be the conduct they would normally do in the course of their daily dealing with these animals.
Mr. Chair. Yes, go ahead.
And that would have been my reading as I look at the exemption here. It says animals subject to good animal husbandry.
Yes.
My concern is with one of the dairies that I know you're familiar with out in eastern Oregon, where the dairies are very large and have a number of employees, and there is some reasonable chance that it would be the employee rather than the owner that might. And my question initially was really addressed to what happens after. And my concern there, if we go to the dairy industry, here is an example. If you just happen to have come back from certain foreign countries and you're the investigating officer, am I going to be able to keep you out of that, off of that property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I'm not sure I quite understand the question.
If I may clarify.
You may.
In the dairy industry, I believe there are certain places you can go or be that you're not welcome on the dairy, that you may run the risk of bringing disease or health problems to the herd. So my concern is, as a dairy owner out here, can I keep you off the property if you come to investigate because you may be contaminating 10,000 cows?
Right. Thank you for the clarification. I think the short answer is yes. Certainly, as any citizen in Oregon or the United States, for that matter, you have the right to prevent entry onto your property under most circumstances. The requirement, if you refuse that, and if probable cause can be shown that a crime is being committed, the requirement would be that the officer would then need to get a search warrant, which would have to go through a court and be signed by a judge to authorize entry. There are no laws that I'm aware of that allow an officer to simply go on anybody's property without at least establishing probable cause or having some sort of exigent circumstance. My experience is that, certainly speaking for my department, any time that there is a reasonable objection raised, such as that would be, to go onto somebody's property, that would be seriously considered and weighed against the investigation in progress. So I think those issues certainly, people are protected by the Constitution against unreasonable search and seizure, and that issue would fall under that.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, that fact situation, Representative Jensen, would not apply to this bill. This bill runs only to veterinarians, and would not. If somebody thought some abuse was taking place at any animal place facility, and could bring that to the attention of the authorities. And the only thing this bill does, it says if a veterinarian becomes aware of what he believes, he or she believes, is animal abuse, only in that case are they required by this bill to make a report and start the investigation.
Representative Sherrilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I raise this only because it's an issue that's close to what we have in the mandatory child abuse and elder abuse statutes, and that is we've addressed in this bill the civil immunity for a report that's made in good faith, and we've also addressed a penalty of a fine for failing to report. What we've not addressed, and I'll raise this just for the representatives of the veterinarians, because I think it's your issue more than anybody else's, but you know, in the mandatory in the other mandatory abuse statutes, we have now the issue, unintended, but still the issue of civil liability for failing to report. That is, when you should have reported and you didn't report, that's come back in through the back door in those other mandatory reporting statutes. I see that as being a much lesser risk in the case of animal abuse than you're going to have in child abuse and elder abuse, but I just raise that as an issue. I see that as being not dealt with either affirmatively or otherwise in this bill, and so at least I think leaving open the prospect that in the right case with the right facts, a court could infer a civil claim for that is against a veterinarian who fails to report when the veterinarian should have reported under this bill. And if you intended the fine to be the exclusive remedy, then we ought to say that. Section 6, am I hearing you whispering? Yeah. I'm not sure that a court would necessarily interpret that as being the exclusive remedy against a veterinarian who fails to report. I think because that doesn't address the civil liability. And again, in an animal abuse situation, I'm not sure how easy it is. I can't come up with the fact situation, but I'll at least raise that anyway, because I don't think anyone was anticipating that in the other abuse statutes either. But it's a hard bell to unring once it's rung.
Correct. And, well, we didn't put a prohibition in there, Mr. Chairman, Representative Chatelet, and I guess under common law, whatever, that might be able to be brought forward. But we didn't talk about it, and we certainly didn't intend to put any prohibition in there or any permission. Either way.
That's sort of our approach, too, David. We say under common law, whatever. our committee's approach.
All right. I knew I was talking to you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm looking forward to reading this colloquy in the advance sheet.
All right. Is there any further questions? Hearing none, I'm going to close the public. Well, let me ask. Is there anyone else here to testify on 255? All right. Closing
Thank
the
Mr.
public
Chairman.
Hearing. Thank you. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 255A.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Chatelet.
Move Senate Bill 255A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Chatelet moves Senate Bill 255A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Cromwell.
Excused.
McPherson.
Excused.
Roblonsky.
Aye.
Chatelet.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. Senate Bill 255A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Sir, volunteer carrier, Representative Anderson. Okay, we're going to go back up to the top of the agenda. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2080. I'm going to invite up Mr. Gardner, Mr. Lane. Okay. Unnamed man with glasses. Ms. Ironman. We got an extra chair. We're set, I think. There's four. Okay. Committee, we had this bill in front of us last week. It's the confusing draw the timeline bill. And we have a dash 5, a dash 6, and a dash 7 amendment in front of us. One of those is not up for consideration. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. You can delete dash 6.
Okay, so dash 6 amendments go away. All right, so we have a dash 5 and a dash 7. Why don't I let you lead off, Mr. Gardner, then we'll come to Mr. Lane, and then the sidebar parties can chime in whenever you darn well feel like it. And you got to identify yourself for the record, or Nancy's going to kill me.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm a partner with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I'm appearing here today for several clients, including Pharma, Philip Morris, and other companies. I have with me Jay Beatty, who is an attorney with the Lindsay Hart firm who specializes in the area of product liability litigation. And I wanted to commend both Jay and Linda Ironman, who spent a lot of time this weekend attempting to hone the policy choice that is presented to you, and I think they both did just a superb job of cutting away a lot of the underbrush of the issues in this bill and coming to you with what I think is a fairly clean policy choice that relates not to the substance of the bill, but to the very important issue of effective dates, retroactivity, and revival of dead claims. What we have in both the dash 5s and the dash 7s is a provision that changes the law in two respects. First, it codifies a discovery rule in the case of product liability actions with regard to the statute of limitations. And the terms of that codification, I am pleased to report, is a consensus terminology from both the defense and the plaintiff side. Second, it deals with the so-called Canberry issue, which is the disparity between the three-year statute of limitations applicable in wrongful death actions and the two-year statute of limitations applicable in product liability actions. And it goes with the longer version of that and specifies that in death cases, the three-year statute applies, even if it is also a product liability action. The place that we part company is on page 2 of both bills, and I will let the my distinguished opponents and colleagues characterize their version of it. But with regard to the dash 7, what we have tried to do, Mr. Chairman, was to capture as accurately as possible what we understood to be your admonition that the revival provisions would revive cases in which there was a judicial dismissal, as opposed to being fully retroactive and then qualified in a more limited way by a filing requirement. We have the touchstone of the Dash 7 amendments is essentially what we believe to be your admonition to us, which was to limit it to situations where there was a judicial dismissal. The other point of difference with regard to Section 2 is that we have not made the revival provisions applicable to the Canberry wrongful death statute of limitations change. And the rationale for that is I haven't heard anyone argue that Canberry was wrongly decided, simply that it was a kind of trap for the unwary. And so the we didn't believe the rationale existed for revival in the same way that it existed with regard to Gladhart. That may be a point in which we could have some discussion if that's a matter of interest to the committee.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Lyons.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of Oatley this afternoon. I, too, would like to commend all of the people that worked since Thursday on bringing you a bill that is almost a consensus bill as far as correcting two mistakes in the Gladhart and Canberry case. As Mr. Gardner mentions, there is a degree of difference in Section 2, and I'm going to allow Linda Ironman, who participated directly with Mr. Beatty, to discuss what I think is really not a difference. Is not as significant a difference as Mr. Gardner may have portrayed it as to the application of the amendments.
Okay, Linda.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The good news is that Section 1 is identical in both the Dash 5 and Dash 7 amendments, word for word. The proponents and the opponents have no disagreement on the main part of the bill. The only disagreement we have on is who does it apply to, and it really is an access to justice issue. In the past, when changes have been made to statutes, primarily statutes of repose, but changes in the products liability area, it's always been to help somebody who has a case pending. For example, in 1995, when there was the side saddle gas tank issue, a woman from Bend was terribly burned, and she came to the legislature and asked for help on her pending case. And the legislature saw an unfairness, and they were willing to make the change and make it apply to her case. The way that the Dash 7s put forth by the opponents of the bill read, that woman would not be helped because you have to have an injury occur after the effective date of the bill. which if we assume that would be January 1, 2004, you wouldn't be injured. You'd have to be injured after that date. And if you were injured today or had a case pending today, it would have no applicability to you. So we think that the Dash 7, and the Dash 7, the revival provision, is extremely narrow because it only applies to cases that have been fully adjudicated, including all appeals, before the effective date of the bill. So we think that the Dash 7 amendments are too narrow in their applicability, and they really only fix the Gladhart problem for the Gladharts. They would fall under the revival provision, and for people who are injured in the future. But that anybody who has a case pending now, you know, who filed a case but it hasn't been adjudicated yet, either because the issue hasn't been raised by the defense or the court hasn't acted yet, they would not be helped by the change. So in Section 2 of the Dash 5 amendments, we've tried to put a more, more fair version of who this applies to. And I will tell you that if it was our in the dream world, the way this started out in the original bill, it would be Section 1 only without the subject 2. It would mean that it applies to every Oregonian, no matter what, no matter when. But we've listened to the committee and the chair and realized that that's too broad. So what this Section 2 does is it says subject to Sections 2 and 3, it applies to everybody. And Sections 2 and 3 limit it to people who have been injured and have actually filed a lawsuit. The difference is there's no restriction on what stage in the process the lawsuit is at. If an issue hasn't been litigated yet, there hasn't been an appeal, whatever, it still applies to them. And we think that's important because, for one thing, the courts are very unpredictable in terms of how quickly they move things, and we can't guarantee that they'll act on anything before the effective date of the bill to bring in the opponent's revival. So I think it is a policy choice. It is a question of really, why are you making this change? Are you making it strictly to help people in the future with a very narrow revival, or are you making it to help people who have moved forward, have filed their lawsuits, and are caught in the Gladhart trap?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mayor, one quick statement. LC added a phrase which was not in the draft we presented to them, which the removal of which might be somewhat of a sweetener. And that is on page 2, lines 14 and 15. After exhaustion of all appeals was not our idea. That was LC that inserted that. So we'd certainly be willing to take that out.
Dash 7s. Yeah, and I agree. I think that that's a narrower category than I had indicated when we talked about a judicial dismissal. I don't necessarily think that if you're going to have revival, it has to, you know, result in going all the way up and getting a court of appeals decision telling you that Gladhart's the law in order to qualify for revival. So I think that's a welcome suggestion. Are there questions? Really? No questions? Gary, Mr. Representative Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the current statute, and this was all run amok because of the Gladhart decision, I understand that, but under the current statute, what would the normal time frame be in which you could file a lawsuit?
May I take a crack at that? Again? And then, under the pre-Gladhart common wisdom, the normal period would have been an 8-year statute of repose, and then if a injury was discovered within the 8-year statute, you would have 2 years to file. Okay. Post-Gladhart, Gladhart looked at the statute and said, that's not what they say. The legislature knows how to say discovery rule when it wishes to say so, as it has done in the asbestos exception and the side saddle exception and the IUD exception. It knows how to say discovery rule, and it did not say it here. That was the essence of the Gladhart ruling, a ruling which we would suggest is, by its terms under the PGE versus Boley rationale, was a correct ruling by a unanimous Supreme Court.
Mr. Lane?
Representative Curl, the law pre-Gladhart is, I think, faithfully articulated in Section 1 of either the Dash 5 or the Dash 7.
Okay.
And I want to also say from the committee's perspective, we appreciate you all working together to resolve the issues of defining discovery and helping us resolve the issue of when the two-year discovery period runs within the 8 years, and I am glad we're down to just sort of smithing the issue of revival. I guess I'm still trying to figure out as I read this and I listen to your testimony, Linda, if we were to do the Dash 7s and we struck the after exhaustion of all appeals language, so we're really talking about people who are judicially dismissed as a result of the Gladhart determination, tell me... And I understand this doesn't include the Canberry adjustments, so the people who missed the boat and thought they had 3 years instead of 2 years, they're not included in the Dash 7s either. Who else are we missing then if we take out the exhaustion of all appeals? Who else in that category do you think we're not picking up that still fits within that sort of construct of people who filed their claims and were judicially dismissed? Is there anybody else, or does that get everybody?
No, Representative Williams. First, on by leaving out, let me just address something that came up in the middle of what you said. By leaving out death, as the Dash 7 amendments do, it not only does not revive the Canberry situation, but Gladhart has death issues. Could have death issues. I think if the committee decided to go with Dash 7, I believe the word death should be inserted on line 7 of Section 2 on the second page so that we treat all people the same. And I believe Mr. Gardner alluded to the fact that he would support that. Now, on your question of who else is left out, the way that the legal system works is the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense that the party opposing the lawsuit raises. And they can choose to raise it at any time during the course of the litigation. And actually, the injured person doesn't have very much control over when it's raised. And so I don't like to speak usually of the legal process as any type of game, but the way this is worded, the defense on any pending case could simply not raise the statute of limitations, so we can't adjudicate it until after the new law goes into effect, and we couldn't, we just don't have any way to get the pending cases to the point of letting them be revived. So this is, Section 7 is so narrow that it only applies to the people whose cases have made it all the way through the legal system, at least to the point of final judgment in the trial court, and have had their case dismissed based on Gladhart. Anyone else whose case is pending would not be affected by this change. They would be left with the old, the rule under the Gladhart case. I hope I've explained that so you can
I'll let Mr. Lane talk, and then I'm going to ask, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name again.
Mr. Beatty.
Mr. Beatty, to respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've sort of come to the place of thinking about this as three classes. I think at some point we've always been talking about two classes of people impacted by the Gladhart fix. I've come to started to think about it as three. Okay, there's the people that actually filed an action. The Gladhart decision occurred. A defendant moved against that party based upon Gladhart. A judge agreed, and that person was adjudicated out of court. That's one class. The Dash 7s would resurrect that claim within 1 year of passage. Then there's a class on the opposite end of the spectrum, which are people that heard about the Gladhart decision, maybe saw an attorney, but they never filed an action because they were told your statute has run. That's on the other end of the spectrum. Neither 5 or 7 attempt to resurrect those people's claims. They are gone. That's an unfortunate situation. Some people are harmed, and they're going to be left remedyless, but that is right. What we understand the ramifications are.
Right.
Then there's this middle group. This middle group of plaintiffs who filed an action, perhaps before Gladhart, perhaps after Gladhart. They got into court. They moved on their rights. They preserved their rights. For one reason or another, an adjudication has not taken place in that case, a filed case, and those people haven't been bounced from court. The Dash 5 protects those individuals. It makes sure that the amendments that we make to the Gladhart, the corrections, apply to those individuals. Doesn't give any more rights to people who never moved to protect their rights. But the people that did, that got into court, that got an attorney, that aggressively filed and pursued their case, those people would be able to take advantage of these amendments, the correction in the law. And that's the difference in my mind now, is of the three classes, and where a class of people that are impacted is those people left in sort of a void. They filed, they moved, they would not be able to take advantage of the legislature's correction of an error.
Okay. Mr. Beatty?
Yes.
You want to weigh in on this discussion?
Well, as Mr. Gardner said, it's obviously a policy determination as to what group of people that this committee decides through the legislation to benefit. And the problem was that my understanding coming into the drafting of this was that the committee was looking at resurrecting a finite group of individuals whose cases had actually been dismissed under Gladhart. And the Dash 7 reflects that direction that I received. It resurrects a finite group of people who have had their case dismissed. And I believe as a policy matter that is a reasonable approach. I personally have a problem with any sort of a revival statute, especially with an insurance-based practice where this is going to wreak havoc on claims-made policies, and there are potential for non-coverage for these revived claims. There are also defendants out there who have been relying on the Gladhart opinion now for 2 years and on Cambury for one. So there is a large number of your constituents out there who believe that they had time-barred claims and absolute defenses who are now told they don't. So as a policy matter, I saw that it was okay to resurrect some, but in splitting the baby, others would not be resurrected or saved. Just as there are plaintiffs out there who thought that they had claims, there are defendants out there who thought they were immune from claims. And that's really the crux of the matter for this group, is determining how to split that baby.
Okay, we are at the splitting of the baby point here. So let me tell you what I think, what motion the chair is going to make. And the committee can follow along or not. And part of my motivation here is we are running out of time. I have to sell a small portion of my soul to get a House bill on the agenda every time I go down to the Speaker's office. And for those of you who know how small it was in the beginning, I'm running out. So here's what we're going to do. The chair is going to ask the committee for unanimous consent to amend the Dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2080. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the chair would move the insertion on line 7 on page 2 after the word, the second word, for, insert the word death, comma, so it would read a civil action for death, comma, personal injury, or then on line 8, property damage.
Okay.
You got it?
Yeah.
All right.
Second four.
The second four. Any objection to that conceptual amendment? All right. It's in the dash sevens. And on line 14, striking the words after and the EX, carrying down to line 15, exhaustion of all appeals. So the sentence would read, a final judgment was entered in the civil action on or after June 8, 2001. Any objection? All right, that amendment, conceptual amendment, is adopted. Now, look, I want to say that I am willing to try to find language and to talk about with the parties about that middle category of participants who have got an action pending but have not been subject to judicial dismissal. And if we can figure out a way to do that, I'm happy to have that conversation when this bill gets over to the Senate. My concern is if we waste another couple of days trying to play around with that, we're never going to get this bill out of the House. And so it would be the chair's intention now with the dash 7 amendments as amended conceptually to move the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2080. Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I will be happy to support your proposal on this, with the caveat that we do try to address that second category on the Senate side.
Okay.
I'm uncomfortable not addressing that, but I do appreciate very much your consideration of the time element and think it's important for us to move forward.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Przanski, then Representative Shetterly.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate what the Chair is willing to do, and I guess I'm going to default to that if that's where we end up as a committee. But it seems to me that I would feel more comfortable making certain that at least going with the dash fives at this point, with the understanding that it be changed the other way, I guess, to the Senate. Because my only concern is that I just want to make certain that, because there is this group of people that everyone's acknowledging that's not covered right now. And not knowing where the Senate may be on this, because without having any preliminary discussions, whether they're going to be willing to entertain that as compared to sending out something that would protect that middle group that we're not currently protecting.
And I understand, Representative Przanski. I guess I'm at the point in this process, not just with this bill, but with a lot of bills, that we are in the situation where some of something is better than 100% of nothing. And I'm worried that we're going to get 100% of nothing if we don't start taking some action. Representative Shetterly?
Well, I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be possible, given the fact that the revival language here refers to the final judgment having been entered before the effective date of this act, which will be January 1. I mean, for a plaintiff that wants to protect themselves, and there must be some mechanism for them to procure a dismissal of their own action, even if they have to file and say, oops, this action is untimely under Gladhart. And judge, we're trying to preserve. I mean, you could play that game the other way around and procure dismissal of your own, can't you? For saying, oh, we filed under a statute that didn't allow this under the Gladhart. It will after January 1 of 2003. So we're filing a notice of dismissal or even a motion to dismiss in order to preserve our rights.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, I'm sure that, given enough time, I could think that all the way through, but a 54A dismissal would not be a judgment as the dash 7 actually. So although I could get a dismissal, it would not apply, so I'd still be left there. And a judgment may entail cost, expenses, sanctions, a potential penalty. So although I recognize there might be a vehicle there, I'm troubled by it as a fix.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'm also troubled by it, too, because under at line 11... It seems to me the adjudication has to be based upon ORS 30.905, and a voluntary dismissal would not do that.
Right. Go
ahead.
Never mind.
I was going to say, the easy answer to the question is that a statute of limitations is raised as an affirmative defense and an answer. If there's some question as to the validity of that affirmative defense, what plaintiff does is move for summary judgment on that defense. The determination on that summary judgment motion, assuming there's a cross motion for summary judgment, will result in the dismissal of plaintiff's case. You file a time-barred claim. I file an answer with the affirmative defense. You, as a plaintiff, file a motion for summary judgment. There's a cross motion. case is wrapped up at that point.
My recollection was, too, at least, and maybe I'm wrong, but I thought you had to, you know, put that statute of limitations on your list of affirmative defenses, or you were gonna, or it was gonna go away, and you weren't gonna be able to raise it.
Probably true too.
So at some point, this gets to a point where you're gonna get an adjudication on it, or the other side is gonna be prohibited from raising it as a defense. Yeah. Representative Ackerman, well, then Representative McPherson.
I think, Mr. Chair, that this discussion brings out the deficiencies in the dash five, at least in the dash, the dash sevens, at least in the dash fives, the class of people that have filed, regardless of the status of their case, now are going to get revived and correct the record and go forward.
Okay, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that I see as remedial of what I really regard as an error in the law. It may have been that the holding was correct on the law as it stood, but I think by common consensus we regard that result as being a nonsensical result. And so I think we need the broadest revival or preservation of claims that we can achieve within the context we're working. So I would prefer the dash 5 amendments as they are our approach at this point. I'll support the dash 7s if that's what it takes to get this bill moving. But
we'll see in a second, because we're going to vote on the dash 7s, and if I don't have the votes, then we'll talk about the dash 5s. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a question, and I do support the dash 7s as amended, by the way, but would, over on the Senate side, would the addition of an emergency clause have any effect as far as reviving the cases that are of concern to Representative Ackerman and Representative McPherson? Because the bill is then going to be effective upon passage.
Mr. Chair, I think that, with permission, Jim Gardner, that's something certainly we can explore and would be willing to explore on the Senate side.
All right. What I have is a commitment that the parties are going to continue to work on this, and I'm happy to have a conversation with the chair of the Senate committee. Again, I think that moving the bill in the form it is, and I think all of us would agree that while we're worried and obviously and appropriately concerned about the Section 2 revival issues, we are going forward with the Section 1, which is the substantial concern that we want to fix as we move this thing forward. So the chair is going to move now the Dash 7 amendment as conceptually amended to House Bill 2080. Is there discussion? We've already had that. So, Nancy, why don't you call the roll?
Ackerman?
No.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
McPherson?
No.
Wazowski?
No.
Federley?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. The dash sevens as conceptually amended are in the bill. The chair would move House Bill 2080 as amended, including the conceptual amendments, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Wazowski?
Aye.
Federley?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. 2080 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. To have this conversation and to ensure that it occurs on the floor, I will assign myself carrier of the bill. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk about House Bill 3385. We're going to open a work session on that one. We got four chairs up there, so why doesn't everybody who cares about this one start to line up in the queue?
Yeah, we did that a lot easier, and then we came up here. That's all we've done. It's kind of like the floor.
Okay, Mr. Bio, you want to start us off?
Yes. Chair Williams, member of the committee, as you'll recall, it was about 10 days ago that we were here on this bill. We generally went through the bill. There were a few provisions that we had some discussion on, but we were hung up on the lien issues. Mortgage bankers were here with some concerns at that particular time. The Dash 3 amendments reflect the agreement that we came to with the mortgage bankers to retain the first first trust deed or mortgage of record as a priority over all other liens. Actually, in the condominium portion of this bill, it was prior mortgage or trust deed, so we've changed that back to first trust deed or mortgage. Both of them now are consistent with one another. We have required that a recording of the lien occur before any foreclosure takes place, and that was to satisfy the concerns raised by the second mortgage lenders who were also present last time, although they didn't stick around for the testimony portion of our work session. Otherwise, until today, we were pretty clear that we had general consensus on this bill. Our friends at the Oregon Association of Realtors have presented us with a list of concerns. I will say that we are prepared to answer those. We feel that there is perhaps some misunderstanding. I'll give you an example of that. The realtors have indicated that there's a substantial concern about this notice of violation issue. We actually talked about the notice of violation issue when we were here last time. I believe that what we have done is try and correct an existing problem, and if I could explain it as follows. Currently, some counties, though not all, but most counties allow you to go in as a homeowners association and record a notice that there is a problem on a particular property. Homeowner associations do that not for their own purposes particularly, but frankly to avoid the problems that occur when an owner comes in who has bought not realizing the property was in violation. And when they get a notice of violation, complains to the association, at which point the association says, the last guy knew, we gave him written notice, go talk to him. And in order to avoid those kind of problems, we have proposed that every county statutorily be told you can record these notices. We believe that by putting in the very specific provisions relating to due process, you have to have a hearing. There has to be written notice. You can't record it until that hearing occurs. This is going to avoid all those last-minute recordings that we now see from time to time where the association hears that Jerry is about to close on his lot and the association president runs down and records something that day, and now the closing is hung up. Because we have in the bill now significant provisions that will provide for due process, that problem is avoided. That's an example of where we think the realtors perhaps have misunderstood the intent of the bill. We do believe the bill is designed to provide a balance between homeowners and homeowner associations. Be happy to answer any questions. I do want to point out that Mr. Bennett, who has been a 20-plus year member of the organization and group that has worked on this homeowner association legislation from the law firm of Landy Bennett and Blumstein, and his partner Karna Gustafson, who also works in this area, have joined me at the witness table today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bile. Do either of you have anything to add?
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman, unless you have questions of us about specific areas. We work in a little bit different areas, Karna and I do, so she more in the homeowner association and I more representing developers, but we do cross over. So if there's some issues you have questions about, we'd certainly be happy to address them.
Okay, thanks. Why don't we go ahead and let Mr. Farmer talk, and then we'll probably want to have some dialogue about the issues that they've raised after he's spoken.
Chairman Williams, members of the committee, Matt Farmer, Associate General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I don't think we misunderstand the intent of this bill. Our comments are more directed towards perhaps some of the unintended consequences of it, and our chief concern, and I think a legitimate concern for this committee, is the ability to cloud title. It may be that in some counties, clerks will allow a notice of violation of something as vague as an other recorded governing document to be recorded in the deed records. That's certainly not universal. I think you'll remember that what can and cannot be recorded has been the subject of some legislation, and I would guess that probably came through this committee in the last session. What clerks will and won't allow to be recorded has become a serious issue because of groups like the Posse Comitatus that file things with no merit, and that is our concern here, is that it may be true that some clerks will allow some things to be recorded. What this bill does is create a blanket ability to record such things. And that's section 2 of the bill gives that permission, subject only to the limitations then found in subsection 2 of it. Those limitations are prefaced by the clause, unless the declarations, bylaws, or other recorded governing documents provide otherwise. What that means is that when I set one of these things up, or should I later as a small association want to change my governing documents, I can basically write around these minimal due process protections. So there is no due process protection, I don't think, really written into this thing. Our concern is not with homeowners associations that operate in an organized manner represented by council, but there are many, many varieties of homeowners associations. They run all the way from a couple of neighbors that found out in the CC&Rs that there is such a thing and form one and take turns being the president and the secretary, up to, I mean, there are just various levels of sophistication in these associations. When you start extending this kind of blanket power, we grow concerned about those less sophisticated associations and how they might use that power then to basically intimidate the individual homeowner, and that's our concern. If I can impose a violation and perhaps even a fine, and then I want to put a lien on the property to enforce my fine, we don't have any problem with that because ultimately that's going to end up in front of the judiciary with the homeowners association carrying the burden. Here, all I need to do, assuming that I don't write any due process, write all due process considerations out of this through my own declarations or bylaws, all I have to do is charge the violation, have a hearing. Now, this conceivably is the same people that charge the violation, so I tell you, hey, you're in violation, you come and tell me that you're not. And then there's may or may not be any appeal process. If there is, it's still all internal. And then finally, whether or not you correct it is completely in my discretion before I'll remove the cloud on your title. So basically what I do is put the cloud on your title, and now I've got Trump for this violation. You either do what I say or you bear the burden and uncertainty of litigation to clear your title. That's our concern with this. Would like to point out to the committee that changes have been made to that provision of the bill that withdrew the fiduciary duty of care for board of directors members, citing specific provisions of Chapter 65. We think that probably works. Our only other concern is we're not sure it's a good idea, although it's not something that we're terribly concerned about, to make liens for assessments and so on valid without any notice whatsoever to the individual, which this does by allowing the declaration to be the notice. So those are our concerns.
Okay. Why don't you guys give us a brief response to those?
Chair Williams, let me take a quick one up on the fiduciary issue, if I might. Chair Williams, members of the committee, with respect to the language that says that the association directors are subject to particular fiduciary duties, what we had previously was a very confusing thing in the statute. Most of these associations are organized under ORS Chapter 65 as nonprofit corporations. Most, but not quite all. Then you have those that are not organized as corporations. There are very elaborate liabilities relative to the Board of Directors already spelled out in Chapter 65. To make the law consistent with respect to all associations, we have indicated that regardless of whether they're incorporated under Chapter 65, they're all subject to the conflict of interest rules, the liability rules, the gross negligence rules that are laid out in Chapter 65. So that's and it's important to realize that that was not done to try and lessen the liability of the Association Board of Directors, but merely to give us a consistent issue on that. And Mr. Bennett wants to address another issue.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, with respect to the lien of the association being perfected by recording the covenant's conditions and restrictions, the issue there really relates to bankruptcy filings. And if an owner has a personal obligation to pay the assessment, files bankruptcy before the lien gets filed, then that lien can be discharged in bankruptcy. And the tension you have here is not really so much between the homeowners association and an individual, but between the individuals, because if that lien that obligation is discharged in bankruptcy, the association still has a whole bunch of expenses they have to pay, and so the rest of the owners have to pick it up. So while you may discharge that obligation personally, if it is a perfected lien, then you may not avoid, the property may not avoid the obligation for that assessment by virtue of the covenants being recorded, rather than someone having to file the lien of record, which may or may not be done. Associations we represent some 400 associations. We are going to probably do that for our clients, but there are a lot of associations who are unrepresented by management companies, unrepresented by lawyers, who are simply in a position of having those liens, those assessments discharged. So,
okay. One last thing that I might comment on to the committee. Chair Williams, member of the committee, already under our statutes, we are allowed to terminate utilities for non-payment of assessments. Already under our statutes, we're allowed to record permits under ORS Chapter 100 for specific architectural features that may be inconsistent with the rest of the rules and regulations. What we're adding in the provisions that Mr. Farmer is concerned about is really nothing new. It merely codifies existing practice and puts some very substantial due process on it. The fact that there is no specific reference to the opportunity to have this adjudicated in court certainly does not prevent an owner from taking this matter into court and challenging the cloud on the title that Mr. Farmer has referred to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I might go further with that. In Section 2, Subsection 2 of the bill, it says, unless the declaration, bylaws, or recorded governing documents provides otherwise, I think the intent of that was unless it prohibits it, so that there may be a prohibition, and I might suggest that we could cure some of Mr. Farmer's concerns, I think, if we had that unless it is prohibited by the document, by the CC&Rs, then you can file it. I think that's probably better language what we intended. Again, I think the tension here is not a tension between the association who's trying to frustrate somebody's right to live in their unit, but rather it's the tension between the buyer and the seller of property. Because in our experience, a lot of people go in, we've had people go down to the crawl space and build bedrooms, go up in the attic space and build something, add a deck out in front. And the association, sometimes they shrug their shoulders and they let it go, but then someone else buys it later on and they're subject, they're thinking, well, that's there, it's mine, I must have a right to use it. And this would enable the association to record a notice of violation notifying the prospective purchaser that occurs. If they have a due process to have to go through to do that, if they did it in error, and in fact it was a permitted encroachment or modification, and most of these are architectural matters, then they would have disparaged the title. There'd be damages. If they lost the sale, you could sue for that. Now, interestingly enough, our office represents seven or eight real estate firms, real estate sales firms. One of our partners represents the Multiple Listing Service, so we see these kinds of things as well as Mr. Farmer. And I think this is really not an issue, I don't think, with respect to the realtor's concern. It's an issue between the buyer and the seller and where that obligation ought to be, who ought to have the risk with respect to architectural changes which are violating the document.
And Chair Williams, members of the committee, I will add that we did have realtor members on the committee that worked on this legislation who were fully supportive of the provisions that are here.
Okay. Thank you.
Chairman Williams, if I might just address a couple of those. We're not aware of any realtors that were on the committee or see any names on the list, but be that as it may, I think the example given of how these violations work is a good one for this reason, is homeowners associations are just people. And they don't act like the judiciary does. So there might well be an influential or brusque member of a community who does something that violates the rules and nobody says anything about it, which was the example. Then when this guy moves out, they want to do something with the next person who they don't like. Under this provision, all they have to do is file a notice of go through the process and file a notice of violation to cloud their title. And then that's true. They get to fight that thing, but now the homeowner, rather than the association, pays the transaction costs of hiring an attorney, going to court, and so on. And that's what we see as the problem, is it shifts the burden to the homeowner rather than leaving it where we believe on the association to prove their violation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 3385. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3426. Mr. Prince.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 3426 is a bill that we dealt with a couple weeks ago. Representative Barker asked that this be drafted, and we were, I think last time, we were looking at the amendments, and we had several people from law enforcement that wanted to make sure that we were that they were clear on what we were doing. So I had a discussion with several people and worked with them, and the result was the Dash 3 amendments. I've talked to John Powell. I don't know if John's here. Talked to Department of Corrections. Brian DeLashman's looked at these. Susan Russell's looked at these from the defense attorneys, and they're all okay with them. Briefly, I want to go through them. If everyone has the Dash 3s, briefly, this bill deals with the use of force by a peace officer in Section 1 then deals with the use of force in Section 4 by a Department of Corrections officer. Section 1 of the bill modifies existing statute ORS 161.239. You might recall our discussion about this last time. We dealt with Tennessee versus Garner, which is a United States Supreme Court case that has been the law of the land for some time, and our statute clearly was not in line with that. The issue was, how do we bring the statute in line with it, and how do we make sure that we don't go any farther than we need to? And the result of that discussion I had is the Dash 2 or Dash 3s. If you look on the first page at the end of the page, what it's doing is it's only changing the standard to the Tennessee versus Garner standard, which is probable cause in the situation that was addressed in Tennessee versus Garner, which is where a person, there is probable cause to believe that a person has committed a felony involving the infliction, threatened infliction, or attempted infliction of death or serious physical injury, and that such force, meaning deadly force, is necessary to prevent the person's escape or flight. That is found on page 2, line 5 through 8 of the amendments. The other amendments then keep the what is the Fourth Amendment objectively reasonable basis, which holds in all other situations, when that would be in page 1, line 23, 24, where an officer has a reasonable basis to believe that such force is necessary to prevent a person from inflicting death or serious physical injury on the peace officer or another person, which is incidentally the same standard you'd have if you were defending yourself, I believe. And then in sub B, when an officer has a reasonable basis to believe that such force is necessary to defend the peace officer from the use or threatened use of deadly physical force. A deals with a reasonable basis to believe that the person is going to inflict death or serious physical injury. Sub B deals with the type of use of deadly force, although they look very similar. So A and B keep the standard as objectively reasonable. Sub C deals with the Tennessee versus Garner situation, probable cause, and that is the law of the land from that case. Section 3 just makes clear that this new section, which is added, which is related to Department of Corrections, will be added to those the statutes that deal with use of force. And I put together for all of you a packet that has runs down the use of force set statutes. I also included page 37 here of the Title 14 of the statutes, just so you know what a peace officer is, so you'll have that definition. And then Section 4, which will become a part of this group of statutes that deal with use of force, is for Department of Corrections. I want to go through that real quickly.
Section 4
of the amendment, excuse me, on page 2.
Which amendments are you talking about?
The Dash 3 amendments.
I have a problem. I don't have a Dash 3.
Yeah, I was working on it.
You don't have them?
Should have just got past that.
They
were in the stack.
Were they?
Oh, here they are.
They are.
I got them.
You got them?
I found them.
All right. So we're now in Section 4 of the Dash 3s, right?
Right.
All right.
And Section 4 of the Dash 3s deal with Department of Corrections, uses the same standard. I want to go through those. Corrections officer or other officer employed by Department of Corrections, again, can use deadly physical force when and to the extent that the officer or official reasonably believes it is necessary to. And then here's the situations. Prevent the escape of an inmate from a Department of Corrections institution, including the grounds of the institution, or from custody. Maintain or restore order and discipline in a Department of Corrections institution in the event of a riot disturbance. And then, or prevent serious physical injury to or the death of the officer or another person. And then nothing in this section will be may be interpreted to limit the authority of a person to use physical force under 161205, sub 2 and 265. That just makes it clear that this deals with Department of Corrections officers and employees only and does not abridge our current statutory scheme when it deals with officers in those two sections. I will say also that the Section 4 is, I believe, constitutional within the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment standard that is used for a corrections officer is well within that and I believe constitutional.
All right, questions? Representative Jensen, then Representative Prezanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure about the constitutionality, and I certainly wouldn't question counsel's observations there. But it is apparent to me, or it seems to me, that there's a pretty great discrepancy between what a police officer on the street may use when a police officer on the street may use deadly force as contrasted to a corrections officer. And I guess if I can, it sounds like regardless of who the felon might be or what they might have been convicted for, no matter how grave the crime or how minor the crime, to run when there's a corrections officer somewhere handy with a gun is to attempt suicide. They're fair game, excuse me. If that's a policy we want to go with, I suppose that's okay, but I have some concern about that policy as contrasted to what we impose upon a police officer over here, where they pretty clearly have to, there has to be some probable cause for a death or serious injury involved, even if it's a felon, or even if it's a person fleeing. They just don't have, according to this statute, the right to shoot somebody fleeing from the scene. This bothers me quite a bit.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I want to address two things you said about Section 4, particularly Department of Corrections. First of all, Department of Corrections in Oregon is going to be felons because to get there you have to have a sentence of 12 months and a day, basically. So I think in any situation almost, unless there was some really unique situation I'm trying to think of, they're going to be felons, not misdemeanors, first of all. Secondly, I agree with you that there is a different standard for an officer, a peace officer on the street, and a corrections officer, and that is it is not an open season standard, certainly. The Supreme Court cases make it clear that an officer, a corrections officer, could not act capriciously or wantonly, and they have to use reasonable force. But certainly the cases like the Whitley case, which was a case out of Oregon here, recognizes the need for corrections officers to be able to use in some situations this deadly force only when there's a reasonable belief that it's necessary. And the standard, as you've highlighted, is a different standard. It's an Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment standard. But I do not believe that this section would make it open season for corrections officers to shoot an inmate. I think that it does set up a statutory framework for when use of deadly force would be justified.
The further discussion, Representative Prozanski, then Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, I guess really for counsel, following up what Representative Jensen says, when I look at page 2 of the amendments, line 22, which is the sub A of sub 2, section 4, it says prevent the escape of an inmate from the Department of Corrections institution, including the grounds of the institution, or from custody. So if we have a scenario where we have a person who's made it into the boot camp over on the coast, which is a very low-level, minimum security type of risk individual. I mean, I read this that if that person is going over the fence, and if an officer believes that is the only way that they can keep them from escaping is actually shooting to kill, that's going to be permissible under this amendment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prozanski, when you look at it, the officer would have to reasonably believe it is necessary to prevent that escape from the corrections. And that would be the standard that they would be judged on. And I think that is actually, I would argue, a higher standard than the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment, which is they cannot be capricious or wanton in the use of their force. But, I mean, I think that is the standard that is in the, I think you're correctly reading the statute. And, so that is the choice. And if you have any questions also, I know Department of Corrections is here, the superintendent's here, their counsel's here, and Stan, I can't remember your last name, is here. Thank you. If you have any questions about the policy, I'm sure they could answer those questions.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I had the same point as Representative Prozanski. I just wanted to add that in all other situations where the officer is going to use some form of probable cause, there's been some physical force, some threat, some act of violence that has intervened, which requires the use of deadly physical force. And I just don't see that element in Section 4, Sub 2, Sub A. And I have trouble with the idea that someone's walking away from a work crew would be technically in an escape and could be gunned down justifiably.
Mr. Superintendent, do you want to direct somebody that works for you to come forward, as I noticed you point? Come on up. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say what I was trying to do with this bill was bring the police officer language into line with the Supreme Court decision of 1985, since we were ancient, out of date. But I had no intention of changing the statute for the corrections people. That's an entirely different job where these people are serious, and if somebody's going over the fence and they get shot, I was not trying to stop that.
Counsel?
I want to bring your attention to the current statutory framework, which I think is in place now. I put it in the packet of statutes. It's ORS 161-265. This would be the standard for a person who's in a correctional facility, and that person is justified using physical force, including deadly physical force, when and to the extent that the guard or peace officer reasonably believes it is necessary to prevent the escape of a prisoner from a correctional facility. That's the current standard.
Okay. That's helpful. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Chair Williams and representatives of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Stan Zerniak, and I work for the Oregon Department of Corrections.
Stan, Nancy's going to want you to spell your last name.
Okay, I can understand that, Mr. Chair. It's C-Z-E-R-N-I-A-K.
Never in a million years.
Standard spelling.
It's just like Parker. All right. Do you want to respond to some of the questions that you've heard the committee raise?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to start out by emphasizing that the Department of Corrections has a very specific policy to always try to use the least level of force necessary before resorting to lethal force. And on top of that, there are only very restrictive circumstances where lethal force can be used. And that does, in fact, include escapes from the secure perimeters of institutions, escapes from the grounds of institutions, escapes from transports, and we do have a number of transports throughout the system for various reasons. And these transports include taking inmates to outside hospitals for medical care, and in some cases, inmates are admitted to hospitals and have to be secured by an armed officer or officers. We also have trips to transfer inmates from one institution to another for either programmatic reasons or for reasons of disciplinary action. We have several institutions that do not have or segregation units, disciplinary segregation units, and we may have to physically move the inmate to a more secure setting to provide disciplinary sanction for that inmate. We also, our policy does, in fact, provide for using potentially lethal force in those circumstances where we have riots, where we have disturbances, where we have threat to the health and welfare, and in fact, in life-threatening situations, to our staff, to other inmates, or to other individuals that may be in the prison. We have volunteers that come into our prisons. We have representatives that come and tour our institutions and the like. And we also can use lethal force in hostage-type situations. But all of these circumstances really first have to meet the test that there's no other way that we can prevent the injuries, prevent the escapes that we're talking about. So we have actually a continuum of force alternatives that we try to use first. But I guess the bottom line really is that our primary mission is to protect the public. And we can't do that unless we have the tools necessary to stop inmates who are, in fact, trying to escape from our institutions, again, if there's no other way that we can stop them.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Zerniak?
Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I think what I've heard from other people, at least my position, is I don't see any problem with the corrections facility being able to deal with people in what is in dash 3 B and C under section 4 of sub 2, where you do have some type of situation where people are put at risk or are in jeopardy of a serious physical injury. And I personally have no problem when you have an individual who is escaping, that's leaving, let's say off a death row, out of some type of secure, higher maximum schedule. But when we're talking about some of these people being on a work crew or being at a boot camp that are in there on very low level offenses, I think it's going to be very hard to justify to the public that person should be shot and killed because they've left the facility. I mean, it seems to me, and I'm not saying it has ever been done, but policy-wise, are we going to not distinguish against someone who's actually has a person felony conviction as compared to someone that may be a small felony conviction for a property offense or some other status offense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, let me answer this way. Our history in this business is full of examples where inmates from even the lowest of custody grade institutions, who again are committed felons to our system, have escaped from institutions throughout the country and have engaged in some pretty horrendous crimes. I'm talking about murder, rapes, kidnapping, and the like. So we have a very, very definite policy to, again, meet our requirement to protect the public. And if I think without that, we are endangering the public. And that whole concept acts as a very strong and powerful deterrent to most inmates, even in those circumstances for which you referenced, to deter them from trying to escape.
One follow-up, if I could.
Yes, you may.
Could you walk us through what type of steps are required under policy, since we don't know what steps are as to when it would reach the threshold of someone in one of these low-level facilities being apprehended by deadly force?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, yes, I will.
Jeff, you want to stay at the table, if you'd like?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first thing I think that's important for the committee to understand is that most of our perimeters are, although they are secure, and they're secure because we do have armed officers on those perimeters, there's not a large number of officers on the perimeters. Even our most secure institution, we may have 9 armed officers on the perimeter, which is a pretty good size institution. I'm talking about Oregon State Penitentiary. So when an officer sees an inmate either trying to dig under a fence, to cut through a fence, or to climb over a fence, the officer has a certain amount of time to make a judgment as to whether or not he can stop that inmate. And the first thing we do is we require the officer to do a warning. And the warning can take the shape of a whistle being blown. It can take the shape of using a megaphone. It can take the shape of a verbal command to halt, to stop proceeding with the escape attempt. If the inmate does not stop, and in the judgment of the officer, the inmate is in danger of being able to successfully escape, then the officer has another option, and that is to use a warning shot. And we do have designated areas throughout around our institutions where warning shots can be given, assuming that there's no other individuals in the area. If the warning shot does not effectively stop the inmate from escaping, then the officer has to make a judgment. And at that point in time, the judgment may be to, in fact, go to potentially lethal force. I'd also like to stress that in the business of corrections in the state of Oregon, when we train our officers to use firearms, we do not train them to shoot to kill. We train to shoot to stop. And what that means is that in their training, they are actually trained to shoot at what we call the center of mass. That's this part of the body here. We don't train them to shoot at the head. So we try to prevent the actual lethality of our responses as much as we possibly can. But I guess what I'm trying to represent to you is that there are just a whole host of circumstances that a correctional officer has to weigh, assess, and measure. If there are other officers in the area who may be able to proceed to the area and grab a hold of the inmate physically, thereby avoiding the need to use lethal force, we'll do that. But very often, when these circumstances happen, and thank God they really don't happen very often, they usually happen at night. They usually happen when we have our minimal amount of staff on our perimeters and, low lighting conditions. And officers do have to make those kind of judgments. The biggest risk, really, I think, is to have an inmate get in the community and to thereby have an opportunity to possibly hurt a civilian or another individual.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cherniak, you say that you need tools to deal with these situations of escape, including, I suppose, wandering away from a work crew or a boot camp or something. Well, we got, first of all, there are tools on the preventive side, adequate security and preparation for handling the work crew in the first place. And then on the other end, in those rare instances, and they are rare, we know, where an escape nonetheless occurs, you've got felony escape charges and other criminal charges that may be brought as a result of this conduct. I guess my concern about this is we're effectively making escape under all circumstances a capital offense that's punishable on the spot by the at the discretion of the corrections officer that's guarding the crew or guarding the boot camp, and I'm just not prepared to go there. I agree that, and I don't have any quarrel with our current law, and I agree that sub C under well, on lines 29 and 30, to prevent serious physical injury or death to an officer or another person, that's a perfectly reasonable standard. I'd say B concerns me. B doesn't address any kind of seriousness of threat to safety, just basically the right to shoot to kill to restore order and discipline in the event of a disturbance that threatens the safety of inmates. Again, it doesn't have any kind of standard for the nature of that threat as C does, that clearly recognizes the I guess the proportionality of the effort here, but boy, I'm concerned about extending the right to use deadly force to the extent that's proposed under section 4 of the dash threes.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, could I comment?
You may.
Mr. Chair and Representative Shirley, let me also clarify that with our work crew supervision scenario that I think you were referencing, we don't have any armed officers. Our officers are unarmed out in the community with those work crews. So, no, we would not be using lethal force in those circumstances.
I guess I come back to the current standard now allows the use of lethal force if it's an escape from the institution. We're talking about just the outside the institution expansion, and it sounds like there are both administrative rules and the fact that they don't arm these officers and these work crews addresses that situation. I guess I'm perhaps slightly less troubled, both because I think it's a low occurrence kind of an event, and because generally I think the threat of that eventuality, even in minimum security facilities, is one of the bases upon which they manage this population. And we got to remember that while not every one of those people is necessarily a violent felon, every one of them's done some kind of crime to get into that institution. And the institutional mentality is an issue that you've got to consider when you've got all those people lumped together. But it sounds like we're high-centering on this issue. And I'm not going to run it out with us being high-centered on this issue until we get some resolution on it. So what I'm going to recommend is it's Representative Barker's bill, who didn't initially intend, I think, to get into the correction piece of it as he was working its way forward. So I'm going to have you, Representative Barker, work with counsel and the folks from the Department of Corrections to determine if there's a way we can sort of wrap the details up on this and to do it quickly. Is that acceptable
sure.
to you?
You bet.
Mr. Chair.
That make the committee more
yeah.
comfortable?
Yep.
Yes.
Representative Przanski?
And I'll be more than glad to sit in if that would be assistance.
All right. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We're
going to
close the work session on 3426. I'm going to jump down the agenda to Senate Bill 397. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 397, invite up Sean Miller and Shannon Poe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Grocery Association in support of Senate Bill 397. Senate Bill 397 comes to you from the Senate, where it came out unanimously out of committee and off the Senate floor. Mr. Chair, retailers, the bill establishes a three-year statute of limitations for actions in civil actions based on shoplifting. Retailers have two options when a person is caught shoplifting in a retail establishment. First option is to prosecute in the court system. The second option is to reach a negotiated settlement, which is in ORS 30, Chapter 30.875, which is the bill before you. Mr. Chair, the law does allow up to $250 in restitution in the bill, and again, the first option of going through the court system with the financial crisis of our state and the court systems, that's really not an option. So the retailers are left to the second option, and that is a negotiated settlement under the bill. The process is an average process of about 18 months, and to my right is Shannon Poe with Winco Foods to discuss that particular process. But I wanted to get into why we are creating a statute of limitations under this statute, Mr. Chair, because there is current law, there is no statute of limitations, and there is two common law statute of limitations that judges have looked at and referred to, and the conflict and the controversy that we're in as retailers is that one is 1 year statute of limitations and the other one is 6 years. The one that is 1 year statute of limitations, a judge actually ruled in a Winco case that Shannon will talk about. It's in chapter 12130, and it deals with the punitive damages statute, which was created for state agencies to impose penalties. So it does not really apply to these civil actions in shoplifting, which is the statute we're referring to. And I know, Mr. Chair, we don't like to legislate under maybe a bad decision of judges, but when there is no statute of limitations, and judges are forced to look back into common law, we wanted to make it real clear under this statute. The other statute was brought on the Senate side and brought up by Senator Ringo, and that is in common law there's a conversion statute of limitations of 6 years. That's ORS chapter 12.080. The problem with that particular statute is it's for damages of recovery of personal property. And again, we're talking about the civil side. The personal property has been recovered, and we're talking about restitution. So it doesn't adequately apply to that statute of limitations as well. And therefore, to make it real clear for the judges and to make it real clear for our retailers who want to go through this route, we feel that a 3-year statute of limitations is appropriate, and we would ask the committee to move the bill to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll turn it over to Shannon at this time.
Mr. Pope. Chairperson Williams, members of the committee, I work for Winco Foods as a director of security. Annually, we catch over 5,000 shoplifters in about 38 stores, which is pretty tremendous. As a part of that, we also have to hire licensed, trained loss prevention agents, and they come at a lot higher pay scale than the normal employee due to the liability exposure. Because of that, we also give them equipment that they can use to identify the theft, which is high-tech surveillance systems. They run about $105,000 to $125,000 per store. When we stop an individual for theft, we try to handle as many cases as we can civilly and not involve them in the court systems. And we do, in fact, probably have 70% of the shoplifters we catch, we handle internally or civilly and not involve them in the courts. We assess that civil restitution statute of $250 to try to recoup some of the expenses, training, camera systems, everything else that we incur. The problem is that 1 year is not long enough to collect on a debt. We found that out firsthand by a lady that we caught here in Salem shoplifting. We send out demand letters, of which we send out three. She simply ignored them. We turned it over to collections. By the time it got to them and by the time they exhausted their resources, it was 1 year and 1 month. She had a good job. She had assets. I went down and filed a small claim suit against her 1 year and 1 month after the incident date, and she came up with this old law that was written in the 1800s of a one-year statute. So we ended up having to pay a prevailing party fee and her court costs because she stole from us. So what we are requesting is 3 years.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Yes.
That's the law.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the law.
Representative Shirley.
I was just looking under 12.110. I would have guessed this was a 2-year statute if somebody had asked me, because it's an action for assault, battery, false imprisonment, or for any injury to the person or rights of another not arising on contract and not especially enumerated shall be commenced within 2 years. which I'm happy with this, but I would have guessed. I would have guessed C if this was multiple choice. I would have gone 2 years.
In that court, you would have been wrong. Is there any other questions?
No, I would have appealed. Then it would have brought a bill.
again, Mr. Chair, to get to Representative Shirley's remarks, having a judge look back at these common law statute of limitations, we would like it real clear in the statute of what the statute of limitations is, and that's why we would advocate the 3 years. So his comment is appropriate.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummell.
Just from a logistical standpoint, you were talking, Mr. Poe, about trying to collect on this restitution. That's not something that the court does for you?
No.
Is collects the restitution? Is that always the case, is that the courts don't? I'm not an attorney. Hell, I don't know what they do, but other than, give fines. But
I think I can answer that, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, is we have one city out of all 30. We actually have 40 stores now spread across 5 states. We have one city that will actively assess and collect the civil restitution for us, and that's Medford, Oregon. But they also mandate that we call the police on every single shoplifter that we catch and put them through their court systems, and then they assess fines as well.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Further discussion?
Just one thing.
Representative Sherrill.
Oh, it's just, someday the law commission or somebody ought to look at this, because now, Chapter 12, you have this, all these statutes of limitation. For instance, here's one that says an action for arising under a rental agreement under Chapter 90 shall be commenced within 1 year. That statute of limitations is in Chapter 12. Now we're taking a statute of limitations and we're appending it to a statute in Chapter 30. It's a problem, I know, for practitioners to know where to look for a statute of limitations to a particular action, because they seem to be all over the place.
That's why that bar publishes the little
book. The little red book. Mm-hmm.
But no, it's a good point. Further,
if I may, comment on that. The retailers have such a problem with this, and the courts, especially as they're getting overloaded now, are turning away minor thefts. This is something that stores can use to help deter their crime, recoup some of their costs, and this is a reasonable, I think, in my opinion, a very reasonable request to extend that for 3 years so they can collect that money from the thieves.
Sounds like we've got a likely bill carrier. thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other person who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 397? Okay. Close the public hearing. We'll open a work session. Representative Barker?
I move Senate Bill 397 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 397 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
Kirsten?
Excused.
Excused.
Satterley?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 397 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker to carry.
Thank you.
Okay. open a public hearing on Senate Bill 259. Invite up Mr. Landauer and Ben Walters from the City of Portland.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. We requested Senate Bill 259, and we thank you for hearing it today. The current statute requires that a litigant against the state notify the AG when a litigant makes a public records request that the litigant knows relates to a proceeding against the state. This bill would simply extend this provision to public bodies, including cities, counties, special districts, whatnot. I've asked Deputy City Attorney Ben Walters to provide you detailed testimony today, and we hope that you will look favorably upon the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walters.
Chairman Williams, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today regarding Senate Bill 259. For the record, my name is Benjamin Walters, Deputy City Attorney in the City Attorney's Office for the City of Portland. I have submitted written testimony, and I won't take up your time this afternoon by reading that document into the record. To reiterate what Mr. Landauer has already identified, this bill seeks to have the current requirements of ORS 192.420 sub 2 extend to all public bodies within Oregon, not merely the state. Senate Bill 259 asks that such public bodies be afforded notice of public records requests in litigation settings so that all parties will be equally informed as to the extent and nature of available information pertaining to that litigation. The bill does not extend, restrict, or modify any of the existing exemptions from the within the public records law. Requiring notice of a public records request to the public body's attorney when there is litigation or anticipated litigation prevents the circumventing of rules that have traditionally protected information during litigation, such as the attorney-client privilege. Records requests are routinely submitted directly to bureaus. That information is then assembled by the bureau. The bureau evaluates the materials, and the records are then released. The employee responsible for responding to the request may not ever be aware that litigation is anticipated or has been filed. Review of the requested materials by lawyers is the exception, not the rule. Tort claims notices are not routinely distributed to all employees to cross-reference with records requests. The amendment is a reasonable means by which to bring legal counsel into the process and achieve a level playing field of information in litigation settings. The City of Portland urges this committee to move SB 259 along to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to present testimony on this bill. I will be happy to answer any questions you may have regarding this legislation.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either Mr. Landau or Mr. Walters? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 259 today? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on, Senate Bill 259. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 259, and we won't be taking that into work session today. We're now going to go to Senate Bill 136A, and I'm going to ask Tom Rorsch. Did I get Roush?
Roush.
Yeah, Roush. All right. What's that WR thing that throws you off?
I know. It's, just call me
Tom. Tom from the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Roush. I'm with the Secretary of State's office representing the Corporation Division at this time. And I'm... In the interest of time, I'll skip remarks. They'll use the written remarks, just first page's background material for you. I do want to note that this bill is refers to the Uniform Commercial Code filings. Some of you have might remember from last session, whereby a creditor or a secured party gives notice through a filing, a financing statement filing with our office to third parties, that there exists a security relationship and a personal property. And for legitimate filers, this is an ordinary commercial activity. There's no controversy to this at all. However, some folks have found a way to take advantage of this activity and twist the filing purposes to their own ends. These filers typically are known as common law folks. In this particular example, it's straw man or redemptionist. You may have heard of these. Typical example, someone comes into our office and they present a UCC financing statement form, but they name themselves as both debtor and secured party, which is just not in the scope of the Article 9 that covers this. As collateral, they list their Social Security number, birth certificate, driver's license, all their worldly goods, past, present, and future, and many other things besides. Additionally, they request typically a certified copy of a filing, which is attested to by the Secretary of State, bears our seal, bears the seal of the State of Oregon, and then they represent this document as evidence that the State of Oregon, especially the Secretary of State, endorses their claim. And what happens when they do this? Well, When they do this, inappropriate filers use these documents and try to use them to evade legitimate obligations such as taxes, child support, traffic tickets. They harass government officers through filings, IRS filings like Form 8300 and some other kinds. And they harass the courts through paper terrorism, as one group has put it. And copies of UCC filings are used as security, quote-unquote, to back car loans and pass bad checks. And indeed, this is a thriving business in Oregon and elsewhere. What this bill does is seek to prevent frivolous and non-commercial filings. It allows the Secretary of State to reject specific inappropriate filings. Rejections for this purpose are part of the public record until the appeals period expires, so that third parties do have notice of this. And there is appeal process through contested case proceedings should, for some reason, legitimate filers take exception or they be involved in this. There really is no harm to legitimate filers, and I really want to emphasize that because that has come up in previous testimony or previous hearings. Junior filers will be on notice about a contested prior filing through the public record of the notice of rejection. And in the unlikely event that a legitimate filing is refused, an appealed filing will get the original date priority position. The bottom line is the Secretary of State will no longer allow inappropriate UCC filings that may be later used for harassment of public officials and to defraud private business. We've worked with Carl Bierre, one of Oregon's representatives to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. They brought the Model Act last year to the session, last session to the legislature that was voted on and passed. The debtor-creditor section, the business law section of the Oregon State Bar have worked on this with us. The Oregon Bankers Association has been fully informed. The Department of Justice and Oregon State Police have also supported this bill, and it passed in the Senate on a unanimous vote. We think it's a good bill. We've worked hard to make good changes to it, and we urge your approval.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Roush? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion or anyone else here who wishes to come forward on Senate Bill 136? Okay, I'll close the public hearing. I'll open a work session.
Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move Senate Bill 136 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 136A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Excused.
Barker.
Excused.
Jensen.
Aye.
Rummel.
Excused.
McPherson.
Excused.
Zonsky.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Aye.
And Chair Williams.
Aye. Senate Bill 136 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier, or should we assign someone who wasn't here? Representative Ackerman. Okay, we're going to go to Senate Bill 216. Open a public hearing. Ms. Holman. When you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm the Assistant Director for Administration and Finance at the Division of State Lands. Senate Bill 216 pertains to our unclaimed property program. Under this program, as some of you may know, the Division of State Lands holds in trust the unclaimed assets of Oregonians until that owner is located and reunited with their property. We hold these assets in perpetuity and until they are claimed by the owner or in some cases by the heirs of the owner. During the period of time that we hold them, the assets are invested with the Common School Fund where their earnings generate a small but important piece of distribution to our common schools. The assets may be unclaimed safe deposit box contents, uncash payroll checks, insurance proceeds, traveler's checks, and other kinds of property. Senate Bill 216 was introduced by the Division of State Lands in response to a comprehensive review of our program over the past 18 months. This review resulted from a number of changes in our program, changes to our internal processes and procedures, the establishment of an advisory committee on outreach, a complete review and revision of the administrative rules of the program, and at the request of the division, a Secretary of State audit of the fiscal controls over the program. Many of the changes and recommendations that these groups made about the program, we were able to adopt internally through our changes in our procedures or through the rulemaking process. But there were a few things that were recommended that we could not do without tweaking the statutes. Senate Bill 216 represents the changes that we need to make to do that. Very briefly, Section 1 conforms the terminology in the unclaimed property statutes to the banking industry, changes that were made in 1997 in the Banking Act. We have eliminated the term banking institution throughout the unclaimed property statutes, which I believe was the only place left in the statutes that that term was used, and changed it to conform with the rest of the statutes by using financial institutions. This change was reviewed by the financial banking industry in the process of amending our rules, and it was also a recommendation made by legislative council. Section 2 continues those changes. Section 3 changes the term, again, financial institution, but it also aligns two separate sections, one dealing with presumption of abandonment for dissolved businesses to a one-year period rather than a two-year period. Currently, in ORS 6674, which deals with unclaimed assets of all dissolved businesses and requires them to be turned over to the Division of State Lands, has a one-year period, so we're conforming those two sections. Section 4 expands the options that we can use to dispose of unclaimed property. We currently are required to do a public oral auction. This, at the recommendation of the Secretary of State, it has been broadened to allow other forms of disposal, such as using eBay and, in some instances, hiring a real estate broker if that's more expedient, but just to allow us these other options. In our rulemaking process, the Oregon Auctioneers Association didn't like this provision, and in most cases, however, we're probably going to continue to use a public oral auction. Section 5 clarifies that anyone who disagrees with the finding of an agency regarding a claim to property may obtain review by contested case. That's the process we would use now, but it's not spelled out very clearly in these statutes. Again, Section 6 does the same thing for appealing the findings of an audit that we may conduct. Again, it's not clear in the statutes right now how we would allow an appeal, and we would do it according to the contested case, but this makes it clear for the person that's affected by it. And finally, in Section 7, we correct internal cross-references to make it clear that the interest rate is established by the director of the Department of Revenue and not a different interest rate by the director of the Division of State Lands. We don't anticipate any fiscal impact from these provisions unless it's to allow us to act more expediently and efficiently and to obtain more money for our assets when we dispose of them.
Okay, are there questions for Ms. Holman about Senate Bill 216? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Why was credit union omitted? Line 20, page 1.
Are you talking about when we... I believe that credit union is included in the definitions that are referred to in the cross-references. There's the 706-008 includes a whole bunch of terms, and I believe that we pick it up that way by the cross-reference.
Right. Do you want to look at 706-008?
I've never known it. Not to give me wrong information. So.
No, I'm sure she's right on. I just wanted to make sure you were comfortable with that. Is there anything else? for Ms. Holman? All right. Thank you, Jeanette. We appreciate it. Is there anybody else here to talk about Senate Bill 216? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session. That's a hint.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 216 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves Senate Bill 216 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion on the motion? Call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Excused.
Jensen.
Aye.
Rummel.
Excused.
McPherson.
Excused.
Lombanski.
Aye.
Chataway.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 216 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Jensen?
Chair.
Thank you. You'll be the carrier. Finally, we'll go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 716. We'll call up John Helen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Helen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Charitable Gaming Association. Before you is Senate Bill 716A engrossed. We do have dash 2 amendments. They are for an emergency clause. If you have questions about that, I can answer those. But real quickly, I wanted to just give you an overview, one, of our association, and two, the need for Senate Bill 716. The OCGA is composed of charities from across Oregon who operate bingo, raffle, and Monte Carlo licensees. Per Oregon statute, only charities can operate those activities. Our members serve a wide variety of charitable needs throughout the state of Oregon, and they're funded in great part through the operation of these charitable games. On the back of my written testimony that I've submitted, there's a sampling of charities that benefit from bingo, specifically here in Oregon. And Senate Bill 716 specifically addresses bingo. Over the last 8 years, bingo revenues to charities have been declining. In FY 2001, net bingo revenues saw a decline of over $460,000. There are numerous reasons that can be contributed to that, but one of the reasons that we've targeted most likely is the ability of tribal casinos here in Oregon to offer unlimited bingo prize payouts. We are limited by statute to $2,500 per game, and then twice a year, a $10,000 game. But those casinos, those tribal casinos, also will take large motor coach international buses and drop them off literally blocks away from our halls and pick up our players and haul them all the way out to the coast or to Grand Ronde or wherever it might be that those other casinos are, and take our players and offer them unlimited bingo prize payouts. As a result, our revenues have been declining, and therefore our charities in Oregon that depend on that revenue have seen significant inability to provide the same level of services that they had been able to provide years ago. Senate Bill 716 is pretty simple, actually. One, we're asking you to allow us linked-style games, which are currently prohibited by statute. Two, allow for the creation of a fiscal or escrow agent to handle the jackpot money that would therefore be created as a result of the linked-style games. And three, lift the prize cap only for linked progressive games, which currently is $10,000 twice a year or, as I said earlier, the $2,500 max. The linked progressive-style games will allow our charities the opportunity to expand our customer demographic by providing a more entertaining and exciting atmosphere, essentially. And for those of you who may have some concerns about whether bingo is gambling, on the back of my testimony, I provided some information that shows that bingo is actually more of a family and a social event than anything. It's a place where people have the opportunity to gather. Just as an example, of the surveys that have been done, entertainment, 62% of the people come for that reason. And then 21% come for excitement. Only 13% actually come to make money. So it's more of an exciting place and a social event for people. And if you've ever had the opportunity to be in a bingo hall, I think you could agree that that is definitely the case. With that, I would respectfully request you pass the dash 2s and send Senate Bill 716A to the floor with a due pass.
The dash 2s, you have had an emergency clause in the bill. Anybody? Well, let's do it this way. Committee members, let's go R11.
Bingo.
Is there any questions of the committee members to Mr. Helen?
Tell me again, Mr. Chair. It's expanded from twice a year at $10,000 to how many?
Unlimited. But that is only for linked progressive-style games. There would still be the regular game that we have now, and we worked with the Department of Justice on this and made sure that our bill was kosher with them. But it would only be on the linked progressive-style games that the cap would be raised.
Representative Jensen?
Mr. Chair, the last time I encountered statutes in this area, as far as the legislature was concerned, was my first session here. When the session before that, they had made, in tinkering with this body of law, the gaming at the Happy Canyon in Pendleton, which is part of the Roundup festivities or activities, somehow or another illegal. In the process, I think, made at that time violations, Class C felony or some such thing. In light of the fact my son was on the board of directors, I had a personal interest in seeing that law change, and I have a personal interest in not seeing us get back into a repeat of that situation. And I'm not smart enough to read this fast enough to know whether there's any relationship. Whether there might be any relationship and any curveballs in here that are unforeseen. And there was a curveball in that one. I think the only thing they were trying to do in that piece of legislation was make gambling off or auctioning off some wine legal to allow the wine industry and I suspect Washington and Westward counties legal. So I'm when I see this statute, I'm nervous.
Well, Representative Jensen, first off, you violated our no baseball metaphor by referencing the curveball. But secondly, Mr. Laybourne, you're here from the Department of Justice. Any curveballs in this one?
The defense rest.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm Ross Laybourne, Assistant Attorney General from the Oregon Department of Justice, and Representative Jensen, no, I don't believe that there are. My recollection is that the problem at that particular point in time was that legislature was considering a bill that was adding the Monte Carlo option that Mr. Helen referred to, and at least one of the bills in the course of that had, I think, inadvertently deleted the Happy Canyon exception, which is another completely a different place in the statute. And so this bill would not have any impact on that existing exception to the gambling prohibition.
The old Happy Canyon exception.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Are you comfortable now?
With this on the record.
All right, Representative Jensen. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Helen or while we've got him up here, Mr. Laybourne from the Department of Justice?
Sure. Are we looking at the dash A2s?
Yeah, the A2s, we're not in work session yet, but the A2s are just an addition of an emergency clause.
Do we have some, I don't know if Mr. Helen's discussed the need for this to be implemented upon signature of the governor.
Chair Williams, Representative Pozanski, we essentially are trying to get this going as fast as possible because we believe that the game has the ability to increase our revenues and stave off any further declines. But in addition, it allows us to work with the Department of Justice to begin rulemaking. And ideally, we would like to be able to have the game in place sometime early this fall and not have to wait until next spring before we can turn our bingo game revenue around.
And Mr. Laybourne, the DOJ doesn't have any objection to the emergency clause, do they?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. All right.
It's a bingo emergency.
It's a bingo emergency. All right. We're going to close the public hearing. We're going to open a work session.
Thank you, Chair members. Many.
Representative Pozanski.
I'd move the dash A2s into Senate Bill 716.
Representative Pozanski moves the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 716. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The A2s are in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 716 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Pozanski moves Senate Bill 716A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay, call the roll, Nancy.
Axelman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Arthur?
Excuse.
Jensen?
Aye.
Cromwell?
Excused. Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 716A as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Everybody here is carrying one. Do you want to take it, Representative Prasansky?
I'd love to have McPherson carry it, but I'll take it.
Well, I could assign it to Representative McPherson.
It is a bingo bill.
All right. It is so assigned. Somebody will have to tell them what it's about.
Oh, I will.
All right. Committee words.